Welcome to the Hoops and Huddle podcast. I am Malika, and today we have an ABA focus episode. I am so excited. I read the book Loose Balls, which is basically an oral history of the ABA. And I was just, you know, it was such a great journey going down ABA history. I had to bring on someone I respect greatly on the history of the game, especially the ABA. Jason Levin is here to talk to me about Loose Balls. So Jason, why don't you introduce yourself and we'll get started.
All right, all good. Always happy to talk about the ABA. So looking forward to this. I wrote about the NBA for a long time, from the late 80s through early 2000s. I read Loose Balls a long time ago, and then got really excited about learning more about the ABA, and did that for a number of years, got to know a lot of the players, and currently working on a book about the ABA. And I guess the most exciting thing is there's a new documentary coming out. It's finished.
I can't wait. I'm so excited about the doc.
You're gonna have to wait, but this is the latest news is good and I guess kind of bad. Two good news. One, I'm one of the main narrators, so that should be fun.
That's fun.
Yeah, you're gonna get tired of seeing my face. So that's exciting. The second good thing is that it was done by Amazon. And Amazon, as you I'm sure know, just announced that they're in big with the NBA now. They got a big part of the contract.
Yeah.
And so the bad news is because of that, they're gonna delay putting it on until early 2026.
Oh.
I know. It was supposed to be early next year, like All-Star Game coming up. But they pushed it back a year because they don't start with the NBA until that year. So they want to...
So it makes sense. From a timing standpoint, it does line up.
It does. And they can do, and this is, I guess, their line of thinking and justifying it, which makes sense, is that they're going to be able to do about 8 to 10 times the promotion that they would have done, you know, this coming year, because they're going to have games, so you're going to see it all over the place. So I think it'll be a much bigger deal when it happens, and that's really good because it's a really good documentary. He took a really cool angle, and you're really hearing from the players, mostly the players, and a lot of the players that were not discussed in Loose Balls or not given a chance to say what, you know, their impressions of the league or certain kinds of questions. And the documentary, it's going to be called Soul Power, and it definitely is going to address a lot of that. So that's very exciting for me because that's one of the main things I've learned from talking to so many ABA players, is they have a little bit of a different look at what they did in the league than that book may imply. So we can talk about that any way you want.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that because when I read the book, my heart went out to the guys because these guys, you know, were seeing it as a shot to play professional hoops. And I feel like if you weren't playing for one of the teams in the big markets, like, you know, or like the Pacers, or playing on Long Island with Nets when Jack J got there, and you know, like in certain markets, you really were playing the way the book made it sound. You were playing in front of nobody, and you know, it was not really appreciated. That's the way the book made it sound. Like so,
right.
So I'm excited to like just have this conversation and dive a little deeper. Like, as we know, the league was founded in 1967. Now, you know, from the book, it made it sound like, okay, this, they really came together because the intent was always to force a merger with the NBA. They wanted to, you know, create such a buzz that the NBA mm-hmm. would have to buy them out. It's just, yep. you know, but so you have people who really didn't have the long money that
exactly.
really was required to long a league, you know, to start a league. Some of them even had to bow out before the league even started because they realized they didn't have the money. It wasn't going to be just a get rich quick scheme that they believed it was going to be.
Yeah, long money is a great phrase. I love that. That's exactly the right way to put it. There was very little, if any, long money in the initial year of the ABA. Well put. Yeah, that's for sure true. Yeah. It the irony here is that their plan actually happened really quickly. And there was going to be a merger in 71.
Yeah.
But they're kind of, and this is why it's ironic, I guess, but their success and the fact that there were two teams bidding for the players made it, you know, finally, after never having been good for player salaries, they finally were able to make some real money. And that's why the players sued and stopped the merger. So it was directly as a result of the ABA existing that the merger didn't happen. So I just think that's I don't know how else to put it, but that's just really, really ironic and kind of funny. And I'm
I
really
thought it
glad
was hilarious because, you know, Oscar in the NBA, you know, Players Association was using as leverage. You know what I mean? Like, and
totally.
That's something that they were not, the owners of the ABA didn't consider that. You know what I mean? Like, and
not enough.
Not
not enough.
enough. Because,
not enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not
like,
enough.
expert move by the Players Association. So what cracked me up when I was reading the book is, you know, the first president being George Mikan. I get it. You know what I mean? You know, George Mikan, because he was Mr. Basketball, especially during this, you know, like he was out of the NBA, but he was still very respected. And they felt like George Mikan, as the commissioner, could open some doors. How did you feel about them being based in Minneapolis, though? I mean, he's a king in Minneapolis, especially at that time, but launching a league in Minneapolis, like,
Well, you know, again, you make decisions, right? And I think that was, I think the book notes correctly, that was part of the equation was he said, yeah, I want to do it, but I got
to
do
have
it
to
out of
be, yep, it has to be
my
in
office. I'm not moving, you know, I have to assume he was a big enough deal that they agreed. But, you know, I think
and
it's
I
important
get
to
it.
Remember. Yeah, it's 1967, though. You know,
it
was the Wild West. I mean, nobody knew anything about anything, really, when it came to this. So they were all just figuring it out. And I'm sure, you know, there were some people when he brought that up, they were like, oh, that's crazy. We can't do that. And then decided, you know what? He's the guy. So why not? You know, we'll see. They just didn't know. They really didn't know.
And I think the key thing, when we think about the ABA, like now, and besides the players and the teams that came into the league, when we think about key things like the three-point line, when we think about the style of play, like it was seen as street ball, but it was exciting ball to watch. You know what I mean? Like the red, white, and blue ball that is used during All-Star as the money ball. All of those things, All-Star Weekend, you know, like those things came and are still present in the NBA today. But those are things that the NBA shunned at the time. So I thought it's interesting that those footprints on the NBA still exist, which is
they're deep footprints. Like you just laid out, you know, half of what the league is all about right there. And that's all, it all comes from the ABA. You know, they dramatically changed the game, and it's the modern game. They took basketball into the modern era much more quickly than was going to happen if there was no ABA. There's just no doubt about it. Because there was, you know, it was new and it was different. They just went for stuff, and the style of play was the right style for the right time, because there were guys ready to really do some stuff on the court. And the NBA really wasn't having much of that. And the ABA said, hey, do your thing. And, you know, right away you got Connie Hawkins, first year, one of the most exciting creative players of all time. So they started out right out of the gate, you know, and then you end up getting Dr. J and a number of other guys. And so they took the game from the ground to the air.
Yep.
I think.
Yep.
And that, and it's never gone back, right? That's it. So pretty cool. And the guys, you know, really are proud of that. I think.
And, you know, players like Steph Curry, they have the ABA to thank for the 3-point line.
They do. No doubt. I mean, the NBA wanted nothing to do with it. They didn't even consider it. And I think people forget they did not take the 3-point line when they did the merger. It wasn't like they went, oh, okay, that's a good idea. They went, no, we don't like that at all. That's not what we do. And they didn't do it. So again, you know, they had to kind of realize what was going on. So yeah, pretty, really, really strong footprint. And it, you know, it's in the book. There's a lot of that in the book.
Yeah, I think it's beautiful that, yeah, the three they brought, those are some of the things, they brought into the league that has a long standing with the league. And you look at the 3-point shot now, I mean, like that you would sometimes, depending on the game, that's what you're watching. You're watching a 3-point contest the whole game.
Yeah. It's gone too far, but
we agree on that. But one thing I wanted, you know, it was very clear with the ABA with the economic struggles throughout the league. You know, you had, you know, like I said, some teams started and couldn't even, some teams had to be sold immediately because the owners didn't have the money. Some teams, some of the players didn't know if they were gonna get paid or not, which is crazy. You give your all, you play, and you don't know whether you're gonna get paid on payday. Like, that's crazy. So the economic struggles were real. You know, if you were on some teams that were in bigger markets and that had an audience, you didn't have the same level of concern with the economic struggle. Some people really, you know, because they were banking on this big payoff from the NBA. The TV contract is what they thought. They even had some commissioners they felt could help them get secure that, but that did not come to pass.
And that killed them. I mean, it killed them. And it's unfortunate for fans too.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I remember as a kid seeing a couple of ABA games and it just blew my mind and really made me a huge fan of, you know, a couple different guys. And I saw the game in a different way, and they had a TV contract. They did air a number of games, but they didn't have a serious contract. It really would have changed the game even more and more quickly with more people being able to, like, who could see Carolina, right? You could never see them play. But they had Joe Caldwell, who was one of the most exciting players in the game. Billy Cunningham was there in his prime. They had two of the most exciting players in basketball, and nobody outside of Carolina or wherever they played on the road saw them ever, you know, no TV. So that was a gamble they lost. And it, you know, it hurt them. It definitely hurt them. This is an interesting one about the money struggles. The team that won the title the first year, Minnesota, moved. I mean, Pittsburgh, excuse me. Pittsburgh won the first championship with Connie Hawkins and immediately moved. And then the next year, Oakland Oaks won the championship and moved. And then the next year, the LA Stars made the finals and moved. So,
turbulent few years.
those are the winner, and the runner up in the first 3 years, having to leave town because they could not establish a big enough fan base. So, that's crazy. When I figured that out, I don't think anybody's pointed that out that way. I went,
that's,
you know,
basically what happened. That's basically
it is what happened. It's 100% what happened. And it's wild to think about it, but that shows you how hard it was. Like you said, without long money, it was a struggle every year for a lot of different teams.
Just
to see if they could make it or if they would have to sell or move or find somebody else to buy in. You know, those kind of things were going on all the time. And the book does a great job of telling
a
lot of
those
stories.
The book did a really good job of telling that part of the story.
Totally.
And I did, you know, I appreciated hearing that. It, you know, I also think about players like, you know, Connie Hawkins with Pittsburgh. You know, he got his, you know, opportunity to play pro ball because of the ABA. You know what I mean? Like giving him that shot before he, had a few years in the NBA. But, people, I feel like people, it's true that people in the NBA really didn't see his prime
Not at
because
all.
by
Not
that
at all. No.
time, same thing with Dr. J, like because there was no TV contract, you know what I mean? You really didn't, get this really, there's really like, I don't know if there's much video on, you know what I mean, on these games or
Well, there isn't, but the good news is whatever is out there, they got 90% of it for the documentary. So
I
there's
can't
going to be
wait.
a,
I was looking
yeah.
forward to this docu. I was like, I'm not seeing any news on when it's coming. And
Yeah, yeah.
now I know not to even look forward to 2020
Don't,
to 26.
no, but they did get a wealth of video that we had never seen anywhere. And that's
That's
awesome. And that,
incredible. I can't wait to see it. To see
it's going to be
players
cool.
like, Connie Hawkins and Warren Jabali and Roger
Definitely.
Brown and to see these players and some of these players in that in action. And the player that one of the players I really want to see is like Artis Gilmore, Bell Daniels, like because I keep hearing about one thing when I was reading it, the Indiana Pacers were like the Celtics and the Lakers of the 60s, basically. Like they were like the best team in the league. And so when you like I was like, I wonder, do people in Indiana realize how rich the Indiana Pacers history is? It didn't start with Reggie Miller. Like,
Well, you
like
know what they do actually.
that's
That
great.
the good news, there's good news there. They really do. It's funny, one of the, it's obviously not in the book, but one of the biggest fans of the ABA Pacers was Larry Bird. He grew up watching that team on TV and going to some games, and that's how he didn't see much of the NBA because they weren't there. And he didn't watch much TV, and there weren't that many games on TV, one a week really. So he saw ABA basketball and he loved it. And like you said, they were the top team in the league for 7 of the 9 years. And so yeah, they are well loved in Indiana, and they do understand how good that team was. They retired three numbers, should be one
That's
more.
beautiful. That's beautiful.
So yeah, and it's all over the arena. So Indiana loves basketball, and they understood and appreciated that there was a great team playing. And it, plus they were in the finals or the the conference finals every year for 7 years in a row. That's pretty astonishing. It should also be mentioned that the Utah Stars, started in L.A., were just that close to being as good as Indiana. They were the rivals. It was an even rivalry. They beat them twice in the playoffs. Indiana beat them twice. The Stars were really, really, really good, but they only won one title, so they don't get as much credit as the Pacers. The book does a good job of their 1 year when they had Zelma Beatty and talking about that season with Bill Sharman, the things that he did that changed the game. So I thought that I learned a lot about that a long time ago, and I wanted to follow up with that. Because I found that team to be really interesting. And then they were great for the next 3 years after they won it, but they had to play Indiana. Only one could go to the finals. And so they just had these unbelievable playoff series, I think 5 years in a row, 5 straight years, those two teams played. That's that was a great rivalry. And the book does a pretty good job of talking about that rivalry too.
Yeah,
The
the
players sure do. Anybody that played for either of those teams just respects the other team because they just went to war every year, 10 times a year in the
Yes.
regular season, and then in the playoffs 5 straight years. And they went 6 or 7 games every time. So it was as
Yeah,
close a
68, 69 that they played the Oakland Oaks and like they lost to the Oakland Oaks, Warren Jabali, 1969, 70, they played the LA Stars.
beat them.
And then, they weren't in the playoffs 70, 71, but then they returned 72, 73 and won both years. And man, such rich history. Lost to the Kentucky Colonels in 74, 75. Like reading about their history and Mel Daniels and just, it was, when the greats of that team, Roger Brown, some of these other, it was really great to, I was like, wow, such a rich history with the Pacers that I knew there was an ABA history, but reading it in here, and I was like, oh, so they were like the Celtics and the Lakers of the ABA. They were the cornerstone. They were that cornerstone franchise. Like to 100%. Me, ABA would be the perfect, for like small market teams. Like when we think about the NBA, you know what I mean? Like I feel like sometimes small market teams get lost, you know what I mean? Like, so
oh yeah,
the potential for, like we don't have dual leagues anymore. Not really, that's respected in the US, but Indiana, I walked away with a deep appreciation for, who they are and what they represented. And it's so interesting when you talk about Los Angeles Stars, Burkina, Utah Stars. Like they started like Anaheim Amigos and then became the Los Angeles Stars, to the Utah Stars. Is it the San Antonio Spurs? They were the Dallas Chaparrals, then the Texas Chaparrals. So it's just interesting. One of the things I forgot to write down in the notes. They said they have Spirits of St. Louis. I'm looking at a chart online, and it has, 70, starters to Houston Mavericks, then the Carolina Cougars, and then Spirit of St. Louis. And then it has here, like in some of the notes, NBA added franchise in Charlotte. Like, how does the Spirit of St. Louis link to Charlotte? Like, I didn't have them to, like,
I don't think it does.
Maybe it's just because they added it. They added, St. Louis and Charlotte are St. Louis. I don't consider St. Louis the South. So
no.
I don't know. That's not that link there doesn't really make sense. Okay. So I'm right to think that they.
Those yeah. That, okay. That's, there's nothing there. The cool thing to me about the Spirits that I thought the book did a really good job making sure that they mentioned it is that they had probably the biggest upset maybe in basketball history. Any league, anytime, even college, they lost to the Nets. The Nets were the defending champions with Dr. J, and they played St. Louis either 10 or 12 times that year, and they won every game, and they won by an average of like 25 points a game. Every game. It was literally the biggest blowout ever that anybody's ever seen. Yep. And then they played them in the playoffs, and St. Louis beat them.
That was such a, I was reading that and I'm like, what the?
What? I didn't know that until I read the book. And I just remember thinking the same thing.
You like, brought that memory back. I was like, my Nets, like what,
what's up?
Yeah. What happened there? Like, so.
Well, I do have a little bit of an answer though on that one, because I was so interested in that I talked to two of the main people. So the point guards for either team were Freddie Lewis. You mentioned the Pacers. He was the captain of the Pacers throughout their entire run, won three championships. And then they kind of screwed him over and he got sent and ended up in St. Louis. And he was the veteran on that team. It had all young guys, almost all rookies, and him are the guys that played. And he really led that team. And I had an opportunity to talk to him about it. And he gave himself a lot of credit, which I thought was cool because he was serious about it. He said, look, I was the one who had been to the, I had three championships. None of these guys had ever even played pro, most of them. They were rookies. And so I just went to them, before the series started. And I said, look, here's your role. This is what we need you to do. And you got to stop screwing around with this other stuff you're doing and just focus on these two things. He said, I went from guy to guy. One was Marvin Barnes, who was pretty crazy, but really talented. And he told him, he said, you need to stop trying to one up Dr. J. He said, I've been watching you all year and you're just trying to beat Doc. You're just trying to impress him and out dunk him and outscore him. If you do that, we're going to lose. He said, you need to score when you have the chance and you need to rebound big time. You're a better rebounder. You need to clean the glass, score the ball. I'll get you the ball, but you need to do that. And he said, I went to each guy, and they all kind of like, yeah, we hear you. And he said, we lost the first game, and I went around and told all of them, see, I told you. If you just do what I'm telling you, we can beat these guys. It was pretty close, but we fell back into stuff we were doing all year. And he said, they could see it. They're like, okay. And he said, after that, we won four straight. And I thought, you know, that's awesome. A championship. Yes, yeah, a championship player who's, you know, doing what a champion should do, and the young guys listen to him. And you know, the young players, once they won a couple, they were like, "Oh, this is real." You know, he's right. You know, we're winning. So then I talked to Brian Taylor, who was the point guard of the Nets, right? So he's the one going up against Freddie. Mm-hmm. And I said, "What happened?" You know, because I was like you. I didn't know. Like, how did this happen? This great Nets team that brought everybody back. And he said they just had egos. You know, guys wanted the ball. And he said, honestly, there were some guys that wanted the ball that weren't Dr. J, and they shouldn't have had the ball as much as they did. And that was a problem. You had three, four guys that wanted to shoot. And it's like we just had ego issues, and it cost us. It just bit us.
That's a shame.
Yeah.
Could have had more success than the Nets have. Well, and even though Nets fans, they don't. I don't feel Nets fans that they respect the history of the Nets.
I don't either. I don't understand that.
I don't get it.
New York. I don't get it either.
Yeah. I respect it.
It's the Knicks, you know. It must be the Knicks influence. But Dr.
No, I
J
get
is...
it. Like, if the Knicks had a history in the NBA, you better believe Knicks fans would know it and respect it. But I get it. I definitely get it. One of the things was, I appreciated that the book talks about is Spencer Haywood, and, you know, like it mentions to Connie Hawkins and the hardship contracts. And really with when you look at the hardship contracts, these are players that the owners felt like they can get a good return on investment in. And really the investment wasn't real money. They were doing these back these deals. I forgot what it's called, like the Dolgoff plans. Where they had so much money in arrears, but you know, but Spencer Haywood got that shot to play, ended up suing, and Connie Hawkins ended up going to the, and then Julius Erving came out via
partnership
contract and kind of, you know, forced the NBA to kind of look at, you know, signing players before they really initially wanted to. And George Gervin, another player that, you know, got a contract, you know what I mean? That, wasn't eligible for an NBA contract at the time. When you look at that portion of the history of these players getting the attention that they deserve, you know, and I think about that, it just makes me appreciate the NBA more that these players got to get some shine. And we got to even experience them more later in the NBA.
Yeah. I mean, I think the book, you know, is a great example of these guys needed an opportunity and they got it. And then the younger guys needed a different opportunity, right? They needed a chance to get in and play and make money and feed their families before their college class graduated. That's just a made up thing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just something that somebody made up and said, well, we're going to draw the line here. It doesn't mean the line is correct. It just means that's where the NBA drew the line. And the ABA was all about, you know, erasing the lines, right? Whatever they could do.
Yeah, erase those lines and give people the opportunity. Ironically, WNBA goes by that rule, either, you know, graduate and or you reach the age of 22. And that's because they don't have the spots. But
must be. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why they do that. But I just love that about the ABA, the hardship, you know, reading about those but I keep the dog off plan. I just wanted they didn't have the money. They really did not have the money to play the players per, you know, what the total number would have meant if they played it over the year, you know, over the active years. They didn't have that money. And that's why they had those back end deals, because they thought they would be in the NBA by that point. They'll merge and they wouldn't be the ones paying out those contracts.
Yeah, it looked good too. You know, it was all PR move too, to say we signed the guy to a $400,000 contract. That made headlines, and everybody was like, "Whoa!" And you know, nobody bothered to look and see that was, you know, $45,000 a year for 3 years, and the rest is, you know, that deferred whatever. You're probably not going to see it money. So a lot of it was PR too, because they were just trying to battle the NBA on every front to try to get people to pay attention, and it did. Those contracts got a lot of attention, a lot.
Yeah,
it wasn't all good, but it was it was real, and they needed that PR, and they needed to, you know, kind of steal players. Like Artis Gilmore was a big one. I mean, for them to get Artis Gilmore was one of the biggest deals of the whole league.
That was a huge one. And
Huge.
Julius, I mean, I'm such a fan of Julius Erving. And one of the things reading this book, like reading his book, and I need to do an episode on his book, reading his autobiography is still one of my favorite sports biographies I've read so far. This book to me, Oozeballs, really doesn't capture Dr. J. I don't think anything can really capture him or anything like that. George Gervin too. Like, I love George Gervin. David Thompson, you know, like I felt like those like mega stars of the ABA really, I don't know. Like I love to hear reading the history of the ABA, but reading about those stars, I felt like you really couldn't get a good grasp. Because Julius Erving was kind of broke up through the book. Like it wasn't like it, and I don't
that's
know.
Right. That's right. It was kind of year by year. So you didn't really get a flow of what he was doing or trying to do so much. Mm-hmm. I would say that I think it's, you know, David Thompson shows up at the end of the book, right? Because he was just there the last year. But he was such a star in college. It was a huge deal. Huge deal for the ABA to get him. He was as big a star probably as there had ever been in college, because he was on TV. He was David Thompson. So he was, you know, doing things that people really hadn't seen. But also he beat, you know, he and his team beat UCLA, and nobody had done that in 3 years. And really in about 10 years, right? Nobody had beaten them when it counted. And he did it on TV, and he did it in such spectacular fashion. He was a huge, huge star before going pro. And so that was, I think, a pretty big part of the merger too, was they wanted Dr. J, but they also really wanted David Thompson, because he was very, very well known around the country. Everybody saw those NCAA games and was excited to see him, you know, in the pros, because he was a spectacular player. And he finally got the dunk. He didn't get the dunk in college. So I can tell you, as a kid watching, that's something that I was very much looking forward to seeing from him, because, you know, we knew, because guys were dunking in the ABA and the NBA, and you know, you knew these guys were ready, and you were going to see some really cool stuff, and he showed it right out. So
even Julius Erving had, you know, great things to say about, he felt like David Thompson, you know, like in a dunk contest, had, you know, like the better dunks, bluntly, you know, like, so he really had an appreciation for David Thompson. And I, you know, for listeners that are listening to this conversation, we are talking about the same David Thompson that introduced Michael Jordan to the Hall of Fame. And, you know, I encourage you to look up David Thompson, the Skywalker. He was, unfortunately, he was one of those players that got caught up in that drug phase. He never realized his potential, but you saw where he was leading, and you know where he was going. And I feel like, you know, drugs robbed us of, you know, a great career, but you saw the potential of what it could have been.
I would recommend people go to YouTube, and you can find the last game of the ABA. It was Denver against the Nets for the championship.
Championship, yeah.
And that final game, like game six, David Thompson puts on a show. Like, you know, it's full Michael Jordan. I mean, it really is. He played a lot like him. Same skill set. Just a pretty player to watch, and all of a sudden would just explode and dunk all over guys at 6'4" at most. But that game, if people want to see and say, well, how good was this guy? Watch that game, especially the first half, and that's as good a player as you ever see. He's just that good an offensive player, and he was doing it against the team that ended up winning it, right, with Dr. J. So he's doing it against the best team. And he's destroying guys, and he's doing everything, jumpers, mid-range, dunks, you name it, he did it, and he did it like it was nothing. He did it so easy. I'd recommend people, it's not even a full game. There's a quarter missing, but you get his whole first half, and that's all you need to see. The guy was just a spectacular.
Really amazing when you think about it. And I'm glad that, there was that documentary, Basketball Love Story. You get to see, some things on George Gervin and David Thompson in that documentary. Also Dr. J, they talk about Dr. J in there as well. I just felt like in a book, you really didn't get a feel for just how least of a score, for instance, George Gervin was. And you know what I mean? They really didn't, really capture that well. Another thing that this story I did not know until I read the book, and that was the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar offer. That he actually, first of all, they were lucky they were able to get a meeting with him, you know what I mean, to begin with. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So
they did.
And they got the meeting and they didn't even present the full the full offer.
The thing that cracks me up about that is, and we've learned a little bit more about it since the book.
Yeah.
Everybody who's listening to this has either been involved on one side or another of some negotiation. I'm sure, right? Even as a kid, mm-hmm. you're always negotiating with your parents. So it doesn't matter how old you are, you understand negotiation. And this was an example of a guy who ended up being a man of his word, and that's Kareem. And he told them, you make me your best offer. I'm not going to screw around and have this become a circus. I want the best offer from each side, period. And whatever you got, bring it, and I'm going to make a decision. And the ABA, especially, I guess, George Mikan. Most people know that in a negotiation, that's rarely how it works, right? You just don't believe that the person is going to be a person of their word and say, no, that was it. And they didn't believe it. They just didn't think that he would stick his word the way he did. They should have known. They did a lot of research on him, and they should have known that that's who he was. Because there was plenty of evidence to indicate that he was that guy. But they didn't believe it. So they went in with a lesser offer, and he said, okay, that's the offer. And he chose the other one. And then, they went, wait a minute. And he said, no, wait a minute. I told you the deal. And they're like, yeah, but nobody does that. And he said, well, that's it. I'm moving on. It's over. So that was that would have changed everything. I mean, everything. That would, the basketball as we know it would be very, very different if he was in the ABA. And I don't think we really know what it would look like, but he was, by far the most important player who had ever played. And if he went to the ABA, it would have changed everything.
Man, that would have changed everything. The seismic impact of Kareem joining the ABA, man.
Yeah.
That bungle, and I get it. Like, when you negotiate, you don't start high. This is a case where, with their research that was done, depending on, reading the book, they know they should have came out with their best offer. There is no way in heck they should have not come out with the best offer.
And they had the check, right? They even made up the special $1 million check. If you're going to make it up, then give it to them.
then give it to them. Like, that was crazy. Oh, one of the things that was disturbing about the book, and we're going to talk about two of those things that, we were thinking about. But the first thing I wanted to was how they talked about selling players. I hated the language, and it applied to all the players, the white players, the black players, but the way they talked about the players, the language used was like, the selling the player. I just didn't, it just gave different connotations. Like, they were indentured servants or something.
That's how they were viewed. I think in the book was, I guess honest in that way. That's just how it was. They were commodities. Like we said, with the ABA especially, and it was also true of the NBA. People forget the NBA had a lot of franchises that were struggling. and not drawing any crowds. People don't understand that. But anyway, it was a fact of life. You know, you could sell a guy because there weren't rules against it, really. And if you needed money, the Knicks did it. The Knicks bought Bob McAdoo. They bought Spencer Haywood.
Yeah.
Right after the merger. I mean, everybody did it, but the language is harsh. It is
the language. It was harsh to read, and I just like
over
and
no
over
doubt
again.
About it.
I was like, what the, like, you know, like, you know, I know we're talking about players that are signed the contracts, but when you think about how the ABA really rarely, you know, you have players that sometimes aren't getting paid on payday, you know what I mean? But they're stuck on these contracts. You know, it's almost like the relationship was like an indentured servitude type of thing, but not you know what I mean? Like, so when you're reading that language and you're understanding that sometimes players didn't get paid when they were supposed to, and when they did, they knew to cash it. If they did get a check, cash it as soon as possible, because it may bounce. Like, this is the reality they were living in, and then you hear this language of selling players. It threw me for a loop. Like, I stopped reading it for like 2 weeks.
Wow. Okay.
That's how bothered by the language I was. I didn't like that.
Well, there's other stuff in there that bothered me that is along those
Yeah,
same
let's get
lines.
To it. Yeah, yeah.
But the selling players, it just was how things were then.
Yeah.
That's just the language.
And that was
used
the
to
language
talk about.
That they used. Because now you
It
have
was.
teams that, you know, you have team when the power, you know, you have the power, player and power movement. So they don't exactly use the same language. You know,
They
I'm
don't
reading
even.
the book now, player empowerment. Back then, they didn't have that. So, yeah, they had that language. Now they don't use the exact same language. But, yeah, players are traded and all of that now, too. It's just that they use a different, and they're paid, but they're not. They're paid on time. They're paid much more money. And they are, you know, the language around it is a heck of a lot different than it was back then, but that stuck out. Another thing that stuck out to both of us is the language surrounding, you know, the players that use more force on the court, quote unquote, more physical on the court, or, you know, the way they talked about Warren Jabali and I think John Bersky, like some of the other players, you know, those, the black players that were more physical versus the white players that were more physical. It's like they were physical players, but the way they talked about the black players was a hint more like they were, you know, I don't know if savage is the right word, but they weren't fit for, you know, being on the court.
And I think that's, to me, the biggest flaw of the book. And that's putting it mild. That's putting it nicely, because I've done enough writing and I've done articles that are oral histories, so I understand how you know, put them together. And people need to understand that when you do that, these guys are not printing the whole interview, right? They'll sit down with somebody for half an hour and they'll get half an hour of tape, and they may only choose, and that's the key word, you're choosing what to use from that interview, right? You're choosing, I'm going to use this quote and that quote, and that's it. And there's 25 minutes of other stuff you got from, let's say, you know, Matt Calvin or Ron Boone or whoever, and you're choosing what you use. So the author is making a very conscious decision. And the decisions he made in this book were, to me, pretty clearly racist.
Yes.
Very clearly. And the main guys that bore the brunt of that were Jabali was the main one. And Brisker to a lesser extent. But those two, they used the word thug to describe them. And the thing that got me is, I didn't see it as much the first time I read the book. I was much younger. And I don't think I had the perspective I have now. But the stories about when the white guys ended up hitting those guys are written as if they're the way they're written, the way they're set up, quote, and then boom, here's the big quote. They're set up in a way that you as the reader are seeing the white guy as the hero or punching out this black guy who's been described to you as a thug, as sinister, as a bad guy. And A, that wasn't true. And B, that's a conscious decision. And I mean, there's one story in there that even at the time I remember thinking, really? But afterward, reading it again, like recently, I was like, wow. Brisker was an extremely tough guy. He was a little bit out of control and he really would fight anybody anytime. So that's all true. But the story in there says that the coach, Tom Nosalke, said, you know, my team was losing like 8 in a row. My job was on the line. And Brisker had been beating up our guys all year. We didn't have anybody really stand up to him. They were afraid.
I remember the story.
But think about it. So he says, I'll give $500 to anybody that fights Brisker. Now, $500 was like $50,000 now. So understand that. That was a lot of money. Now, people, they need to understand that. That was like, whoa. Everybody in the locker room went like, whoa, that, okay. And one guy says, yeah, put me in. I'll do it. Lynn Chapel. And so far, you're thinking, okay, this is an okay story so far. But then they tell, the quote is, they throw the ball up for the jump ball, and he just turns and decks Brisker. And that is, and you're supposed to read that, the way it's set up in the book is, you're like, oh, cool.
Oh, he fought back. Like, he fought.
Well, he dropped him. He fought the big, tough, savage, tough guy, and he just clocked him. He took care of business. And you think about it, that is probably the cheapest shot you can throw at any point in the game, is when they throw the ball up. That's the one. There's no way you're thinking that. And the guy can't. That is, you need to be thrown out of sports for doing something like that. That's so cheap and cowardly. But that's not how it's written. It's written like Brisker got what he deserved when this guy just straight up cold cocked him. That is, you know, and there's other stories about Jabali that are similar. And I can just say that I talked to many different players, African-American players and white players, and their version of Jabali is not at all what is in the book. I mean, not at all. So there were some decisions and choices made there. And some of the guys that gave the quotes, I'm going to call him out because there's a guy named Rudy Martsky, who's in there quite a bit. He was a PR guy at the time. And he has some pretty terrible things to say about Jabali and a couple other guys. He ended up being the media writer for USA Today for 20 years. He was an extremely powerful person in sports media, especially when USA Today was like the only, you know, national thing. And he's just a straight up jerk, mildly. And he's the one that has a couple of those stories and comments in there. And so the author chose to interview him and use that stuff, where he's just making Jabali look terrible. And clearly it's just because he's just an idiot. And he's, so that part of it really, really bothered me, because there was another situation where Jabali got hit. And again, you're supposed to think that the guy who did it is this great hero for finally taking care of this guy. And again, it was a cheap shot. And Jabali has spoken about it. He's passed away, but he was asked about it, you know, after his career. And he said, look, he goes, you really think that I would let a guy walk up on me in front of me and knock me out? Does that sound like something I would do? And the person doing the interview said, well, you know, no. He said, look, I'm just being straight with you. There is no way I would let anybody walk up on me, because I was a fighter, sure. And he said, guys fought all the time in the NBA. It wasn't just me. There were fights all the time. And if you saw a guy walking up to you, you knew it was on. He said, I mean, did anybody else ever hit me like that? No. He said, he hit me from behind, knocked me down, and, you know, okay, fine. But if you read it in the book, it quite clearly does not say that. It says that he, one of the stories says that he, you know, he knocked him out and made it clear that he saw it coming and just got clocked. And so, again, that's some pretty questionable making by the author to set it up that way. And that's not how any of the African-American players in the league saw Jabali at all. And I got a very, very different picture of who he was off the court and on the court as a teammate. They loved him. And I would add that there's one quote in there. I reread it today from Al Bianchi, who was his coach, his second year in Washington after they had won the championship and moved. And his quote is, I love the guy because he played super hard for me every night. He played hurt, and he was a phenomenal player. He was our best player, and he played harder than anybody on the team. And that quote is thrown in there, but it kind of gets lost in all the other stuff.
Because they talk so much about, you know, fabricated, you know, negative stuff on his physicality that that comment gets lost.
Exactly. And so I think to me that that put a lot of the book in different light, and talking to a lot of the players really changed my opinion of things that I had learned from the book that, that turned out to be just straight up not true. So I think that that needs to be acknowledged. There's a lot of great stuff in there, and it's great that the guy wrote the book. It's still the only book, you know, really on the ABA, and it's fun. But you know, there's some things in there. Also, I can say that the players do not appreciate the fact that the book focuses so much on the funny kind of guys not getting paid, weird halftime contests, low crowds. They don't appreciate that because they were pros. They got paid to play the game. They played hard. They were just as good as the NBA for a good probably 5 years of the league. And they don't appreciate the fact that a lot of people think, yeah, it was kind of a clown league. You know, guys were stupid and fighting. That really wasn't the case, especially at the top level for the top like four or five
And
teams
I
every year.
understand that. I totally understand because the way the book made it sound, it was like, you
A
know,
clown show.
like it was a clown show. It was like a circus. You know what I mean? It wasn't really a
And it's
real
just,
professional league. And it's like,
right.
that's not
It's just,
true. You know what I
that's
mean?
just so not true. It's incredible. And the fact that you can see what the ABA guys did when they got into the NBA. They just dominated, straight up dominated the first few years. So clearly, you know, they were playing, and guys are pros. They went out there and did their job. They played hard. They wanted to get paid. They wanted to have a career. They weren't out there screwing around. You know, there was a lot of fighting in the NBA too. They never talked about it.
Right.
The
There's
fighting
only
got so bad they had to put in rules, right? When Kermit Washington, you know, hit Willie Tomjanovich, they, oh my God. Prior to that, there was a big article in Sports Illustrated about the enforcers in the league. Like it was a good thing. So, I mean, fighting was part of the game, but the way they've done it in this book was disappointing. Not surprising, but very, very disappointing for
Now,
me.
we know that the ABA eventually did merge, and the New York Nets became New Jersey Nets, and they lost Julius Erving. I feel like the Brooklyn Nets have been cursed because of that. Because we couldn't afford to pay Dr. J. You know, you have San Antonio Spurs, Indiana Pacers, you know, like, and the Denver Nuggets, they all came in to the NBA. And one of the questions that's burning in the back of my mind is those four teams, I'm assuming those four teams, at least their dog-off plans were honored for those four teams.
I don't think it was by team. I'm not really sure. I don't really have an answer to that. I don't think that's the case.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But
I
I
am
don't know.
curious about the book, the way the book described all these deals. I'm like, did these players get, I know the new, there was a ABA, there was a new pension plan that was announced that will put a, you know, some dollars, some necessary dollars in some of these players that are still here, you know, put in their pockets. That's long overdue. And I was like, at least they get that, because I don't think they got this dog off. Some
No.
players did get it, some players did not.
Correct. And for the ones that did not, they were really sold some false, you know, that's lawsuit type stuff. If they, you know, only a couple of them sued because they didn't really know what was going on. Plus, I don't think they believed they were being lied to that badly, but they were.
Yeah, they were.
A lot of agents were involved. That's in the book too, which is kind of interesting. A couple of guys are pretty honest about that. The
Yeah, some
agents really
agents were taking money off the top. There were some
yeah,
agents,
they're
some corrupt
working with the
deals.
teams. Yeah, working on the backside with the teams, really against, kind of against their players' interests. I mean, again, it was the Wild West, you know. That was happening, by the way, in the NBA too. You need to know that same thing was happening in the NBA, but to a lesser degree, not with the Dolgoff plan, but with the agents. But yeah, I think it's player by player. Some guys did get paid a majority of what they were supposed to get. A lot of guys did not. And
A lot of guys did not. And
no, no.
I'm, you know, what I'm sad about is that we won't get the doc. I'm looking forward to your book, because we need another book out there, because this book, Loose Balls, respect that there's a Loose Balls at least out there to read about. the ABA, and really, but we need another source too. We need, you know, another book out there that people can read about the ABA. So besides just loose ball. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah,
the
I'm excited.
Spirit of St. Louis is a story that cracks me up. I just didn't want to rush through it. So I may cover that as a separate segment, you know, to end another episode. But the Spirit of St. Louis, those owners caked so much. They got so much money from the NBA from the deal they cut, you know, the merger. It's insane. Like they don't, you know, the owners of Spirit of St. Louis, did they only have the team for 2 years and they ended up making, but because they were the last owners, you know, when they added that, you know, thing, that no one knew what TV was going to become. Like they'll get a small segment, like a really small percentage of the revenue of the four teams that, you know, were merged in the NBA, or just 2% of the NBA TV money, and what that would become, like the bane of the existence for David Stern for years. Like, go ahead.
People should know he's the one that negotiated the deal.
David
Stern
negotiated the deal.
He was the young lawyer that made the deals like that one around the merger. That was actually his job. He was the hotshot young lawyer that was given the task of doing that. And that's the one time, or at least in his view anyway, it's the one time he got beat bad in a negotiation. It's because of two words, and it's in the book, and those two words are in perpetuity.
In perpetuity, yep.
Which means forever. And that means forever. And that's the part.
And I'm shocked that those words were actually in.
Well,
But
I mean, this is how it works, right? You know this just like I do, and everybody listening. When there's a negotiation, when there's a contract, each side is trying to get the best they can get. And it's up to the other side to find it, right? And if you put something in there that benefits you and doesn't benefit the other side, it's up to the other side's lawyers to go through it and say, "Ooh, we got to take this out. We got to take that out. We got to argue about this. We got to argue about that." And that snuck through. David Stern missed it, or didn't think enough of it. And it cost them hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars over the years.
Yes.
And they just stopped. They just stopped like 4 years ago, I think.
Yeah,
they
stopped.
Finally,
they
finally bought them out.
Got an exit clause. Yeah, they got them out.
Astonishing amount of money. I mean, it just boggles the mind. But again, there's one guy, his name is Don Shupak. He's the lawyer that did it. And I think it was just a case of a lawyer taking the shot, right? You know, trying to do the best he could and thinking that if I can sneak this one in there, you know, maybe. And he did. And it was on David Stern, who then became commissioner and had to write that check every year.
And had to write that check every year as a reminder of his era.
His whole career. He wrote that check.
Yeah, so, and that cracks me up. Like that cracks me up, but it also made me angry because you know they didn't pay the ABA, you know, got off with those horrible, you know, like dog plans. And I was like, these owners had enough to at least play the Spirit of St. Louis players, their dog off plans with all this money they were making, and they most likely didn't get it, nor did most of the players in the ABA, and they had millions and hundreds of millions of dollars and didn't matter. So that part of it just made me sad when you think about it that way.
Well, but I will give you one bit of good news on that. Freddie Lewis, who we talked about earlier, who was the captain of all those Pacer championship teams and then was on the Spirits when they had that big upset of the Nets, and he was the guy that made it happen. He stayed friendly with those owners. They were the owners. They bought the team the year he got there. And so they really liked Freddie. And they employed him in a number of different jobs for about 10 or 15 years after his career ended. So, I mean, that was nice.
That was nice. Yeah.
I'm not going to go any farther than that. I don't know if they did it for anybody else or didn't, or how everyone else they handled stuff, but they did do that, which I give them credit for. So he did. He thinks they're great. And he appreciated it. He told me straight up, you know, that was great. And I love those guys. I appreciate what they did for me. So, you know, they did do that.
So that is, I appreciate that they should be appreciated for that. But for the other guys, at least, you know, the ones that are still with us are able to experience and get, you know, a few dollars a month from the NBA's as compensation to help them, you know, like, if, you know, the ones that are still around.
I can tell you from talking to them that it's meaningful to a lot of the guys. And it's kind of sad to say that because it's not that much money, but $15,000, $25,000, $35,000 a year at this point, we're talking about guys who are 75, 80, 82, 83 years old, is coming in handy. So it's not even close to what they deserved or should have gotten so many years ago, but it is appreciated by the guys that are getting it, and it has helped a lot of guys already. So that's good. I'm glad it happened. A lot of people didn't think it would ever happen. And it did. So there was a lot of work done by a lot of good people to make that happen. And, you know, the players do appreciate it. I talked to a couple of guys, and I guess it made me smile. I imagine it'll make you smile. But when the first checks came, apparently they weren't expecting it. Like, they didn't know the date the checks would come. They were told kind of what expected around a certain date. So they didn't really know. And the checks came. And for some guys that played a number of years, they were a little bit larger than they thought. And I think they included like a 50%, not a bonus, but they were 50% more than the guys expected. I guess the date started earlier. So if a guy was expecting like 25,000, he got 37. And anyway, these guys got the checks the same day, and then they all got on the phone and called each other.
Wow.
To share the good news and be like, hey, how much was your check? Because I got more than, oh yeah, I got this much. And they, you know, told me
those calls
were fun. Yeah, and that they kept in touch. Some guys after that, they reconnected a little bit, reached out to some other guys to see to make sure that they got it. And I think it was kind of a brotherhood thing. And a positive thing. And when you're 77, you don't get a lot of positive financial news.
No, that's a blessing for them. And you know, like, I thank you for the news that the documentary is coming 2026. It does align with the new with the new NBA contract and timing. I thank you for your time tonight. I've held you for over an hour. And I appreciate you dedicating this time to discuss the ABA with me. I love the knowledge you share in, you know, our group chat. I'm happy to be to learn from you guys, and thanks again. I'm gonna let you go, and I'm gonna continue to prepare for this ultimate draft we're doing later.
There you go. That's gonna be fun.
I might have to rewatch that ultimate draft that Charles Barkley and Ernie Johnson and them did as part of All Star last year or the year before.
I'm gonna look at that real quick and check that out.
Harry West was part of that one, so I'm gonna check.
Oh, that's right. That's right. They did do that. Well, that's what we're doing. That's essentially what.
Yeah. So I'm gonna look that up. But thanks a lot.
Good.
And you have a good night.
Well, thank you for having me, and you have a great night too. Thank you.
Bye.